This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Before George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, there was Michael Brown, an 18-year-old black man who was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. Brown's death inspired the fledgling Black Lives Matter movement, and Hands Up, Don't Shoot, a line derived from accounts of Brown's final words, has been a rallying cry of protests against police violence ever since. But Michael Brown probably never spoke those words. An exhaustive Department of Justice report later concluded that the claim that Brown held his hands up in clear surrender came from sources who later acknowledged that they didn't actually witness the shooting, but rather repeated what others told them. And that account was inconsistent with the physical evidence, which instead corroborated Officer Darren Wilson's claim that Brown had attacked him and tried to grab his gun. In contrast to other police killings that have since energized the Black Lives Matter movement and national protests, including that of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, shot while wielding a plastic gun, of Eric Garner, who died while an officer held him in a chokehold, and of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, there's no reason to believe that by shooting Brown, Wilson was acting unreasonably, as Barack Obama's Department of Justice concluded, because Wilson was under attack. Writer and filmmaker Shelby Steele went to Ferguson to investigate the large meaning of Brown's death and the international reaction it inspired. His new documentary, a collaboration with his son Eli, is called What Killed Michael Brown? Born in Chicago in 1946, Steele, a former college professor who specialized in Russian literature, is the son of a truck driver and the grandson of a slave. His views on how to correct America's racial injustices are deeply influenced by his experiences in the late 1960s and early 70s working in a poverty program in East St. Louis. He believes, provocatively, that what killed Michael Brown is, and I quote here, the liberalism that put him in public housing, that expanded welfare payments so that his family broke up, the fatherless home, the terrible education, terrible schools, terrible public housing, the destructive school busing, close quote. In place of today's increasing focus on identity politics, Steele believes we need to focus on citizenship and the experiences we have in common if we are to deliver fully on America's promise. I discussed that with him and his latest film, What Killed Michael Brown. Here is the Reason interview with Shelby Steele. Shelby Steele, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the elevator pitch of the documentary, What Killed Michael Brown? How do you summarize what the movie is about?
It's not easy, but basically, there's so many things I can say. I think the elevator pitch, the quick pitch that might work in terms of what we tried to do here in this film, is that there are so much falsehood that comes out of incidents like this, where you have a black teenage boy and you have a white trigger finger. Bam. In Chicago, at the same time, this decade of 2014 and so forth, around that time, about 3,000 black boys a year were being shot on the south side of Chicago. 3,000. 700-800 a year killed. Most of the kind of genocidal numbers we're talking here. Very little attention. President, you know, I don't really remember whether he said much of anything. Nothing happened. Michael Brown, one teenager, trigger finger, a white policeman. The whole world is involved. People from Europe are arrested, demonstrating in Ferguson, Missouri. Why? What we want to do is look at what is the reasoning. Where's our culture at? That it would engineer this kind of explosive focus on a single little sort of backwater suburb of St. Louis when there were so many other difficulties.
So what did you find? I mean, one of the things that is amazing, and it's 8 years ago or 6 years ago that this took place. You talk about the kind of falsehoods or the mythologies that grow around this. Coming out of the Michael Brown shooting was the slogan, "Hands up, don't shoot," where Brown supposedly, presented himself, where he was giving up. He was surrendering to the cop, saying, "Hands up, don't shoot," and he was shot. That's one narrative that came out of that. You found that is, problematic for any number of reasons. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. "Hands up, don't shoot" implies that Michael Brown was murdered in cold blood, essentially, by a white cop for no more than walking down the middle of the street. In other words, it expands the sense of black victimization. And one of the things that I'm curious about for a long time is how black victimization has become the major source of power available not just to blacks, but to the American left in our culture. If you can prove that blacks were victims, then you sort of invoke that long history of oppression, racial oppression in America, slavery, segregation, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, the shooting of one young man makes us accountable to that entire history. It's as though the one incident is going to be made to pay off for all this history that precedes it, that gives it a context. So the context is so important in terms of power. And so that's really what fascinated us, how black victimization works in that way.
And I mean, in the documentary, you point out that both a grand jury investigation, as well as various federal Department of Justice inquiries, found that that story of that Michael Brown was just a regular kid walking down the street and then gets plugged by a racist white cop, presumably racist, was not true.
Right. It's absolutely not true. There were two grand jury reports. There were two Justice Department reports. There was an FBI report. Not one of them found a single shred of evidence to suggest that racial animus played a role in the death of Michael Brown.
And I guess
what fascinates us is this: the entire world is reacting as though he was a victim of racism. Racism is systemic. He was a victim of it. He was not. Well, the difference between the reality and this magnificent story of victimization is poetic truth, a truth designed to use victimism to win power, not a truth to reveal reality, but to win power for, in this case, blacks and the entire American left. Takes enormous power now from racism. It's not just racism anymore. It's systemic racism.
It's white supremacism.
It's white supremacism.
That is a totalizing system that infuses every interaction of every day, even if blacks and whites are not interacting.
Whites then are guilty,
right?
And they owe me. And I'll pull that cord if I have to. And I have a certain license. I have a certain power that I can wield in American life, inside institutions. I can make major corporations give hundreds of thousands of dollars to Black Lives Matter. I've got some real juice here, some real power, as long as I can keep alive that idea of black victimization.
You in the documentary at one point you say we blacks made a very bad deal with white America. Can you explain? Because on a certain level, your personal history, your family history, and the history of America, there is no question that there was an unbelievable wrong done to African Americans in this country, and that racism institutionalized racism, de jure segregation, lasted until at least the 1960s, in fact, if not in, you know, in specifically in law. So what are the terms of that deal that you say in this documentary, as well as in other work, that blacks made with white America?
It all begins in what I call, it happened in the early 60s, mid 60s, past 64, passage of the Civil Rights Bill and so forth. At that moment in history, America made what I call the Great Confession. It finally, after centuries of woeful oppression of blacks, beyond maybe the worst instance of oppression in human history, America finally, and quite bravely and quite honorably, confessed, yes, we did it. And it was wrong. It was, we colluded with evil. Well, the problem is, when you make a confession, you put a cudgel in the hands of the people who are extracting that convention, that confession. They can, from then on, they have that over your head. This is the beginning of white guilt in America, because now I can say, well, you know, you oppressed my father, you're guilty. And you will not have legitimacy until you somehow regain the moral authority in this area. Well, boy, look how that distributes power. So now, as a black, all of a sudden, Stokely Carmichael says in the mid-60s, black power. We've got the power now to have an impact on things. And we've had that power since the 60s. Whites live in America today under the accusation that they are racist and therefore illegitimate. That's what white America lives with now. That's the price it paid for its past. So what motivates social policy, the government action, welfare, war on poverty, great society, so forth? What motivates that is that those are programs that we say are designed to uplift the people that we once oppressed, but in fact, those programs have nothing to do with uplift. They have to do with regaining moral authority for whites who need it desperately. President Johnson, public housing, school busing, everything was, there were social programs everywhere.
Now, can I ask you, to talk about your experiences in the Great Society? One of the most fascinating parts of the documentary is, first off, it's obviously the topic is really tightly focused and of the moment, but the archival footage, you worked in the infamous Pruitt-Igoe housing complex that was in St. Louis that became a synecdoche for the promise and the failure of the Great Society. Could you talk about your experiences there? What were you doing there and how did it turn out? And how does that inform your indictment of the Great Society and of a kind of white guilt that you've been articulating?
Well, I was actually in East St. Louis, which at the time was famous as being the poorest black city in America. An unfortunate thing to have to brag about, but yeah. It was the sort of precursor to the black underclass. Most of the city was on welfare. The government was police cars were a rare phenomenon because the city had no money to buy them, and crime was ripe. Drugs were coming in, and the breakdown of the family was horrific. And our program was set right in the center of that in East St. Louis. And we took in kids who from East St. Louis. They were the idea was to give them the first 2 years of college, the first sort of community college in a program, EHE, Experiment in Higher Education, which would train them, give them the first 2 years of college, and then they would move on up to Southern Illinois University, which is in Edwardsville, about 20 miles away or so forth. So I worked in East St. Louis with that population of young people.
Oh, and just so I can correct myself, Pruitt-Igoe then is across the way in St. Louis itself.
Right. Pruitt-Igoe was beginning to fall apart while I was there. So we witnessed it. We were offered students from there who were encouraged to come to our program. None ever did, but they were encouraged to. But it, again, in East St. Louis, I began to see that it was very, very easy for us. And I'm not a bad writer, so they would assign me the job of writing grants. And I could sit there in an afternoon and write a grant and bring in $20,000 to set up a library, or to do some other thing. And then money came. People who ran it began to drive fancy German automobiles to our little school inside in the center of East St. Louis. In other words, I began to see that there was a white guilt, as I later came to understand, made a space for black corruption. Our grievances paid off. They paid hard cash. It wasn't just that we could claim racism, it was that we could get paid for it. And this began to establish a paradigm, I think, in black America that created what we now call a grievance industry in black America, which basically lives by claiming racism and by sort of shaking down whites. You owe us this. If you don't give us this, if you don't cooperate, we will call you a racist. You will be illegitimate. You will lose standing and so forth. So there's this sort of symbiosis that started. And I saw that begin to unfold while I was there. We were not just there to educate those kids. That was an incidental, secondary concern. Our concern was to use it to get somewhere, to make something, make things happen.
In a different documentary, which is available online, an old Frontline from 1990 about a killing in New York by white teenagers in Bay Ridge, New York, part of Brooklyn, of a black kid named Yusuf Hawkins. This is a documentary you did for PBS called 7 Days in Bensonhurst. You quote, or you say, "Race is a mask through which other human needs manifest themselves." Can you apply that to what was going on, or your experience of the Great Society? So it's that race became a way, racial grievance and white guilt, as you're defining it, became a means by which disenfranchised people suddenly could get power, wield it, and get money.
That's right. My sense of grievance gave a way for whites to sort of step in and earn back their moral authority. And so that became the symbiotic bond between whites and blacks. And you have to remember, we live in a very, very wealthy society where there are enormous funds. I mean, today, corporate America can give $100 million to all sorts of causes and so forth, and support this sort of grievance industry.
And you, I mean, I guess part of your, or a huge part of your critique, that's the basic dynamic, but then you stress, in your view, that most of these helper programs, certainly in the past, did not work, and they don't work today. At one point in What Killed Michael Brown documentary, you talk about how in 1940, a period in which Jim Crow was still being enforced, 87% of black families or black people were in the poverty. And by 1960, with very little changing, and certainly not in terms of affirmative action and other kinds of set-asides, merely the lifting of some de jure segregation, 47%. That rate had dropped 40 percentage points to 1960. Why did the programs then that, you know, in, you know, that were instituted under the Great Society, why do you think they didn't work to uplift people, regardless of the motivation of why whites were doing it? Why, you know, why didn't the programs work?
One reason: they stole from black people agency over their own fate. They said, "You're poor, we victimized you, you're therefore underdeveloped, backward. we will take responsibility for your uplift. You will find, you will achieve uplift, not through yourself, but through the things we do for you. The new programs we create, the way we get resources, the use of racial preferences and affirmative action and so forth. We will socially engineer you up to parity with other, with all other groups in American life. That was the kiss of death. That was worse than segregation. Segregation didn't steal your own, your agency like that. They just said, tough cookies, live with it. But after the 60s, after white guilt came in, whites no longer could do that. So they had to, again, to get their moral authority back, they had to sort of pay us off for the past. And we still to this day, that symbiotic bond is still there. Amazon, the huge company like Amazon, canceled this has the resources to cancel this film, not show it on their, not stream it.
They did relent in that, though.
They
right?
did finally.
Originally, so.
They did finally relent, yes.
Yeah.
But they they had that power.
Can we walk through the 70s and 80s? Because, you know, the Great Society, you know, is 40 years old, 45 years old. In the 70s, there was clearly a strong political and cultural battle over things like affirmative action. By the same token, blacks got access to higher education in vast numbers compared to what had been before, and to jobs in corporate America, to government jobs and things like that. How do you account for, I mean, what are the key markers of black progress since the Great Society? And how much of that do, you know, what are the great achievements? What are the great gaps? And how do you suss out in your personal calculus what is due to helper programs and what is due in spite of those? And how do you kind of make sense of where we are now versus where we were then?
Well, again, I think that, you're right. It's an interesting tableau to sort of look at. I think since the 60s, white America has made one of the greatest moral advances in all of history. I speak as somebody who grew up in segregation, know it much better than I'd like to, what it's like, every aspect of it. And I live in a profoundly different America today, profoundly different. And in the span of my lifetime, that kind of progress is just, well, America doesn't have the moral confidence to give itself credit for such an honorable thing, such an honorable achievement.
And can I just, given your vast writing and documentaries about this type of thing, I just want to, could you briefly retell two incidents from your, you know, not even your childhood, but from your adolescence and early adulthood? One is that you've written about how you were a very good swimmer and you quit swimming because the coach wouldn't invite you to a party that where the person in this, you know, requested no blacks attend. And then you also had horrible experiences in Utah after becoming a PhD and trying to rent an apartment with your wife, who is white. Could you kind of just quickly recap those and kind of discuss how far we've come from those types of attitudes?
Yes. I was on the swimming team in high school. I was a sport I was actually gifted at. So I was, I was good at it. I was the captain of the team and had been since I was 8 years old, swimming at YMCA swim meets and so forth, and loved the sport. And between at the end of my junior year in high school, I was starting just to get a little bit bored with it. But I vowed to go back in my senior year and really give it everything I had.
Mm-hmm. What year was this?
This was 63.
Okay.
And a friend of mine who I'd been swimming with since we were 8 years old came up and he started to tell me about this wonderful party that the swimming team had at the summer vacation home on Lake Michigan of the coach. And his family had a summer home there, and they had invited the swimming team up, and they just had a ball for 2 weeks and got in trouble at night and played all sorts of tricks. It had a great summer vacation, and how he was so happy by it, and how it was just so bad, that too bad that I had to work that summer and wasn't able to join. Well, I had to work, but as I say, my parents would have happily let me go to such an event. They had, everybody there had somehow realized or come to realize that you couldn't have blacks there. Just wasn't going to happen. You couldn't do it. Now, they didn't say this explicitly to each other. We have to find a way to keep Shelby out. But they said, we have to find a way to keep Shelby out. And that meant they had to scheme. They had to plot. I saw many of them during the summer. There was no reference to this good time. And so on. It was just this one kid who finally broke. And he didn't think I would. He didn't understand why I would be upset by that. Well, that was life back then. I wasn't shocked. I didn't fall to pieces. I didn't. That was the world I'd always known. And you. What were you going to do? You had to live with it. As it turned out, it helped me understand that I really was done with swimming, and that I didn't want to spend my time doing that anymore. There were better things to do. And so I've never regretted the decision of quitting, even though I was the captain of the team. But then immediately when I quit, I was showered for the rest of my time in high school by white guilt. And everybody trying to separate themselves from this act of deception that they had all engaged in to keep me out, and apologizing and confessing and story after story about racism in their family. So I was like a priest there for a while, hearing all these confessions. Well, this is where I began to understand it's not just what happened. The story of race in America is not just what happened with blacks. It's what happened with whites. Whites have never been the same since the 60s. They have lost. There has been an injury to their moral confidence. They doubt themselves. History speaks for itself. Evil was committed. Their forebears were a part of it. And so there's this sense of, again, having to do things to restore moral authority and catch up. Well, we're still, I think, caught up in that symbiotic bond, and we have to break it. We have to find a way out of it.
So, you know, I guess to follow up on that, one thing that is in preparation for this, I looked at a series of social surveys of attitudes towards race and attitudes of whites and blacks towards, you know, whether or not they consider racism or discrimination to be a primary factor in getting through life, in succeeding. Since 2013, starting in 2013, Gallup saw a significant decline in people who said race relations in America were basically good. In between 2013 and now, whites in 2013, 72% said race relations were good or somewhat good. Now it's 46%. In 2013, 66% of blacks said race relations were good or somewhat good. Only 36% say that now. So these are really giant declines. Before the Michael Brown murder, which touched off a whole, you know, a national discussion about police brutality, about racist outcomes in policing, things like that. What do you think explains the decline since, you know, the early 2010s? What's going on in America? You know, and this is also when Barack Obama is in the White House. So on a certain level, we have a president who's mixed race, who has delivered on, you know, at least symbolically on, you know, that America has gotten somewhere better on race. What do you think explains the decline in people seeing race relations as good since, you know, over the past seven or 10 years?
Well, I think that the main reason, again, goes back to the fact of this great confession that I was talking about in mm-hmm. the 60s. One effect of that was to make, again, the phenomenon, the reality of Black victimization, the victimization of Black people, a source of power. And it's white guilt that makes it a source of power. Whites say, okay, we did it. What do we have to do now to get that monkey off our back? And that's our relationship. And so the people who pay for that relationship are Blacks. Because here's what they have to do and what they have done. We came up with a victim-focused identity. To be Black is a victim. If you say, the one thing you can't say to a Black is that, hey, you know what? You're not a victim. You might get a fist in your face. We have become invested in our victimization because it's our power over whites, over America. We can use it. We can, and we do. And so the idea that we're not victims is just unbearable. Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem with that. The minute you say you're a victim, you're dead. You're just dead. You're cut off from your own resources. You're cut off from your own energies, your own sense of destiny, your own individuality. You're cut off from all that, and you are worst of all, you are dependent on the same people who oppressed you in the first place. And so again, when I look at my father, I see a man who was born in the Deep South in 1900 with a third grade education, do what he did in life. But now somehow, because you're Black, you can't do anything because you're a victim. If you told my father he was a victim, he'd tell you you were crazy.
Do you think there's a kind of bifurcated response, though, among Blacks? Because clearly, you know, upper class Blacks, highly educated Blacks, people, Blacks with high socioeconomic status may talk about being a victim of persistent and systematic racism or white supremacism. They benefit tremendously from wielding that kind of power. They write for the New York Times. They do things like the 1619 Project. They get tenured positions in universities. They do very well in corporate America. But then it's the larger number of Blacks who are further down the ladder that are really paying the price.
That I would agree with that. The sort of upper rung is benefits enormously. I think the large portion of the Black middle class is supported by the victimization of Blacks, by the power that comes out of that. And you're absolutely right. Beneath that, this, because again, it's the same thing. When you're a victim, then you don't have agency over your own fate. You don't have control over your own, you're helpless. And so it was liberalism, the liberalism based on this, that created the first Black underclass. When I was growing up in segregation, there was no Black underclass. Everybody worked. Everybody.
So even if people,
there was no.
Yeah, when you say Black underclass or there was no underclass, you mean it's not that people weren't poor. It was that they were
working. They were not an underclass. An underclass is a spiritless, defeated class of people. Mm-hmm. That didn't exist. They all worked.
Michael Brown, to go back to Ferguson, Michael Brown lived in that underclass.
He was a product of that underclass. What killed Michael Brown is that liberalism that put him in public housing, that expanded welfare payments so that his family broke up, the fatherless home, the terrible education, terrible schools, terrible public housing, the destructive school busing. This is what victimized Michael Brown, broke his spirit. I personally believe, it's just my personal belief. When you plunge at a officer of the law who's got a gun pointed right at you and you keep coming and you keep you know, it's almost, you know, a little suggestive of suicide by policemen. Mm-hmm. He didn't cherish himself, as Bob Woodson talks about in the film. He didn't care. Well, where does that dispiritedness come from? It comes from the fact that of Black America having come to rely on its victimization as its power. It was the worst deal we've ever made in our history, and it destroys us. It's destructive.
And since 2012, this is kind of fascinating to me. According again to social survey data, this is from places like Pew Research and Gallup, white liberals are now less likely than Blacks to say that Blacks can get ahead without special help. White liberals are further to the left than Blacks in America are. Yes. When it comes to questions of racial discrimination. What do you think is driving that extremeness among white liberals? Because, and then the other thing, we're talking, I think we're both in California. California just defeated a ballot initiative that was an attempt to roll back race blind or colorblind admissions to public universities in the state. So it seems as if, you know, on the one hand, there is a recognition that racial discrimination, that affirmative action has its limits and that it shouldn't be used in things like higher education. And then you have this segment of whites who are further and further to the left on this. How do you make sense of those things?
Yes, they are further and further to the left. You know, again, it goes back to this same sort of a phenomenon. The problem with whites, they don't really give a damn about Blacks. They support all these junky, terrible policies like affirmative action, which is despicable. It's the most racist thing the government's ever come up with. They support programs like that because it gives them, they can then say, I support affirmative action. I support diversity and inclusion. And they can, you know, just cheer themselves on as wonderfully moral people. They can restore the moral authority that America lost back in the 60s when it confessed. So they're concerned about their own moral restoration. They don't give a good you know what about Black people. Black people, in a kind of lapse of of perception, I'll put it as nicely as I can, see this vulnerability in whites and say, that's our chance. There's our money. That's where our bread is buttered. So we love affirmative, and they play that game. The problem is Blacks don't have the confidence to believe they can make it on their own. White liberals have stolen this from Black Americans, stolen it. White liberals say, we engineer you. You don't engineer yourself. We don't respect you. We know you dwell in inferiority. And so, therefore, we are responsible for you. Well, this is my outrage at a policy like affirmative action. Here, it's distilled in that policy. All this corruption is distilled in the policy of affirmative action, which takes over Blacks and stigmatizes them as literally inferior. Says, you wouldn't be here if it were not for the largesse of we whites who are removed from racism. It's a sick, ugly deal.
It's worth pointing out that under, you know, going on almost 15, 20 years of race-blind admissions to the University of California system, both the representation of minorities as well as the graduation rates have increased. So, you know, that's a good sign, right?
Is it?
No.
Because I think when I sometimes visit campuses and I talk to Black students and they show me a certain respect because I came along a few years before there was affirmative action. I had to really compete. When I went away to college, you didn't put your race on the application because you knew they'd reject you. You hid the fact that you were Black. Well, the day it's reversed. But then because I went through then, they will say, you're the real deal. The implication is we're not. You've stolen our thunder for your own innocence. It's a pernicious, thoughtless, dare I say, evil thing to do to a race of people. Put them in that kind of a position where they have to be beholden. What whites should do if they really love black people is say, I know you can do it. I know you can do it. Go for it. We'll support you in every way as you go for it, as you take agency over your own life, and you make it happen.
One more question about the kind of shift back to feelings of implication in racism by whites. According to Pew, whites under 30, 18 to 29-year-olds, 61% of whites under 30 say that people are not seeing racial discrimination where it is actually taking place. The same percentage for people between the ages of 50 and 64 is only 40%. Why do you think younger people, younger Americans, are more attuned to talk, white Americans under 30 are more likely to see racial discrimination than whites who are middle-aged? Is it
because, that has become a kind of a measure of their innocence, of their superiority to the generations that came before them? So it's a kind of generational vanity to think in that way and to compliment oneself in that way, but again, at the expense of the people you claim to be helping.
Yeah, you don't think that they're responding to different material realities, that they are seeing, you know, an America that is actually fundamentally racist. It's not out in the world; it's in their head.
No, when somebody says America is fundamentally racist, it's a power move. It's a power. How could you say such a thing? I've lived in America all my life. I don't know. What are you talking about? I walk around every day all when you start talking about it being some sort of blanket thing, somebody's making a power move. Mm-hmm. That's a corruption. As we say, race, anytime you use it, it's a means. It's not an end. And it's always a means to power. And it's always a corruption. Absolutely, every time, always. It's never good.
What is a way forward in your worldview? I mean, I think in your body of work has done, you know, you've documented over really 30 years in the public eye, going back to, I think, the content of our character, which really brought you to the national stage in the early 90s. What is a way forward on racial issues or racial discourse? How do we get out of this trap that I think you've elucidated extremely well? You know, what do we do?
I think that there are many, and I'm open to hearing them. But one way I think out of this is to shift the focus from race to citizenship. Race has given us a sickness where we keep investing everything, power in identity, not in citizenship. But now we live in a society where identity is everything. If you're gay or lesbian, if you're black or white, it's all identity. And we pursue power through identity. That's evil. That's never going to work out because I can't join your identity. You can't join mine. You can't be black tomorrow. This is what we have in common. What is important is that we're both citizens, lifelong citizens of the greatest country that ever existed. And that our citizenship grants us equality under the law. We have the same the wonderful democracy to continue to encourage us as citizens to be responsible, be on the side of the good and so forth. Well, one of the things I would love to see is citizenship understand, that citizens understand that identity is the enemy of citizenship. It will corrupt citizenship. It is a corruption. Identity is this idea that identity is also a wonderful thing. You know, black is beautiful, black power, blah, blah, blah. No, it's not a beautiful thing. Whiteness is not a beautiful thing. You're just white or you're just black. If you are an honorable man or woman, then citizenship, your discipline as a citizen should involve relegating your identity to a very minor place. That's what democracy offers you the opportunity to do. That's what we ought to focus on, it seems to me.
What do you hope to accomplish with the release and the viewing of What Killed Michael Brown?
I think that many of the subjects we've just been talking about, white guilt, black power, all these sorts of things, I just don't ever hear them really talked about on a wide level in American life. Things that are just blatantly have nothing to do with if whites could really begin to understand the phenomenon of white guilt, it's not a matter of feeling guilty. It's a matter of being accused. It's Kafkaesque. You stand accused of evil because you're white, and you don't like that accusation. You squirm underneath that accusation. And you sell yourself out and you sell your principles out in order to deal with it, in order to avoid that accusation, to fend it off. You make identity a big deal. When in the modern world, you should not. Well, I think that's what, that's where I hoped that people would begin to talk about race on that level, that we are all blacks, whites, everyone. There are subconscious forces at work that undermine our honorable and good intentions, which I think are there. I believe in them.
Are you, we're in a moment, a spasm of identity politics, as you were discussing. There are books like White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, How to Be Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi, The 1619 Project, helmed by Nicole Hannah-Jones at the New York Times, which put racial identity and charges of white supremacists, of totalitarian white supremacism at the forefront. Are you confident that ideological power play will actually be engaged and rebuffed?
Oh, it probably, the rebuff part, I don't, it certainly has been engaged. It breaks my heart to see young people today, after all this time, 60 years since the 60s, basically devoting themselves to the expansion of the idea of black victimization and create concepts, white supremacy and all this sort of, is simply, and all it does, it's systemic racism. It just expands the idea, it expands my entitlement. Now, it shows the grievance industry is addicted to that. And they, if you're at the New York Times and you wear your grievance on your sleeve, you're going to get promoted. You're going to move up in the world. And so it's like any time people reach for race, identity, corruption follows. And now we've got this sort of fashionable victimization to somehow deal with and grow beyond. I think we will, but it's going to take, we're wasting time with it. It's a waste of time. We need to develop our citizenship in this independent, self-sufficient people who understand the danger of identity as a meaningful public concept, political concept. It's Hitlerian. Not to you. You never use Hitler as a metaphor, but it is fascistic.
Use him as an adjective.
An adjective. It is where you use a collective identity to completely oppress a people.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Shelby Steele, the author most recently of the documentary film What Killed Michael Brown. Thank you for talking.
Well, thanks so much. I enjoyed myself. Maybe too much.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.